can say for certain that Toyota intentionally concealed information and misled the public about the safety issues behind these recalls. Now, our years-long investigation, criminal investigation, examined the way the automaker disclosed complaints about problems of sudden acceleration associated with many of its most popular Toyota and Lexus models. Rather than promptly disclosing and correcting safety issues about which they were aware, Toyota made misleading public statements to consumers and gave inaccurate facts to members of Congress.
Attorney General Eric Holder announcing a $1.2 billion settlement with Toyota over the way it handled deadly problems with its cars back in 2009. And it all stems from the issues of sudden acceleration, which led to the death of a California family who couldn't stop their rented Lexus until it crashed. Here to explain more on today's news and to look at some of the other big stories going on in the auto industry is journalist Matt DeBord and our regular car guy. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Madeline.
Remind us of the basics of the story. It goes back to Toyota's sudden acceleration problem. What was that?
Well, initially we thought it was an electronics problem. There was a lot of speculation about this, that there was something going wrong with the electronics that govern the vehicle. You know, when you step on the gas in your car, it's not like there's a direct connection in most vehicles between the accelerator and the engine. What's going on is that it sends an electronic signal to the throttle, and it tells the car basically how fast to go. So there was a lot of speculation that there's something wrong with in-vehicle electronics. And this didn't actually turn out to be the case, or at least it was not substantiated in any significant or scientific way. But that doesn't mean that Toyota didn't have some kind of culpability for failing to communicate, as Eric Holder just said, this information in a timely way to the proper authorities. So that's what they've gotten in trouble for. Basically, we've settled on the idea that what really was going on here was that maybe the accelerator pedal was getting stuck. Maybe people had a problem with the floor mat getting stuck on the accelerator pedal, that sort of thing. And that was what was causing these cars to go out of control, to accelerate suddenly beyond the control of the driver. The real issue here, though, is the kind of criminal aspect of it. This is settling a criminal charge. Toyota doesn't have criminal culpability for these specific issues. What it has criminal culpability for, as far as the government's concerned, is not communicating in a timely fashion that this stuff was going on. So Toyota didn't reveal that they had received complaints in a way that satisfied the government. And you just can't mess with the government on these criminal issues as far as it. This is why it's a criminal case and not just a regulatory slap on the hand for not doing the recall fast
enough. And $1.2 billion, though, that seems like a lot for just not telling the government about something.
Well, that's huge. But the thing is, it goes at safety is the thing, mm-hmm. right? Clearly what's going on is automakers need to be much more aggressive about revealing what's going wrong with their cars if it could affect the safety of the passengers in those vehicles. The other thing is that the government wants to make very clear, you know, through this settlement that it's going to be costly if you don't communicate the information in a timely manner. They don't want to have any more of these massive, very public recall issues where the CEO, for example, of Toyota had to go up and testify before Congress. And the government just wants to make very clear that it's going to cost you a lot of money if you're not revealing information. If you try to keep it, it's almost like there's the old world of the car business and there's the new world of the car business. We live in a world where everybody needs to have all the information that's available to them right away. And the government does not want car makers to sort of say, well, maybe, I don't know, sort of, man, I'm not so sure. But no, we need to know immediately if something's going on that the public could perceive is undermining the safety of the vehicle.
Okay, that brings us to GM, which has just issued another recall and a public apology. Now there are three investigations. It's a big mess. And last time you were on the show, you talked about it. But let's go over it again. What happened?
It's huge. The first recall affected a number of GM small cars that are actually no longer being sold. They're not in the market anymore. The small vehicle that is at the center of all this is the Chevy Cobalt, which is a small car that GM stopped selling. There are still Cobalts on the road. The problem is that what can happen is that the car will get in a crash and the ignition will be turned off. The ignition system will be jostled in such a way that the car turns itself off. Let's say it hits a tree or something like that. And if the ignition's off and the engine's not running, the airbags don't fire. So this is catastrophic, obviously. I mean, airbags save lives. They're one of the biggest innovations in safety that's come along in the auto industry since they started putting seatbelts and things like mm-hmm. that in cars, right? And you're now basically surrounded in many cars by airbags. So if the engine's off and the airbags don't go, there's a very good chance that you will either be very badly injured or killed. So it's very serious business. On top of that, what's happened is that GM has begun to reevaluate everything that it's doing as far as safety. And this is the imprint of Mary Barra, who's the new CEO of the company. And they've added another million and change vehicles to the overall recall. Some of these are for airbag issues. It's unrelated to the ignition issue, but it's another airbag issue. And then there's a smaller recall that involves possible fires that could break out due to a brake pump in some vehicles. The total is now about 3.3 million overall vehicles that are being subjected to a recall. This is almost like old GM coming back to haunt new GM. Mm-hmm. GM before the bankruptcy in 2009 was a company that might have always thought, well, recalls are recalls. They happen all the time. You know, we're GM. We can deal with this. They were sort of used to suffering the slings and arrows of customer disgust in some ways. And so it's like, oh, we're GM. What do we care? You know, we're the biggest car company in the world. So what? But now what's happened is that GM has totally remade its image and is trying to be much more customer friendly, much more responsive to customer needs. It's trying to recast itself as a viable car maker for the future. And they have Mary Barra, who's the first woman CEO of a major car maker in the world. And this is just a little bit nuts for her because she's not been on the job very long and she's had this massive recall issue land right in her lap, and it's gone right at a critical issue. It's not like this is, you know, a small thing. It's not like there's a malfunctioning window switch or something like that. This is airbags. This is safety. This is all the kind of stuff that people are really invested in as far as their cars are concerned. And to Mary Barra's credit, she's really been very aggressive about going after this. I mean, they've appointed a new safety czar at GM. Now, you might think it's amazing that they haven't had a safety czar in the past, but they haven't. They've appointed a new executive to look after nothing but safety in GM vehicles. And she's really flooding the zone. I mean, she's going after this very
well,
hard,
she has
very
to,
heavy.
Because she doesn't, then she might get a fine and you know, she might be accused of stonewalling. It just doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. And I think certainly what has happened to Toyota may happen to GM as well in the future. I mean, if you figure that Toyota has been fined $1.2 billion for not informing the government of what was going on in a timely manner, this with the sudden unintended acceleration issue, which didn't constitute a decade's worth of ignored data, GM is in a much worse position if they don't deal with this very aggressively, because this is 10 years worth of people saying something's wrong here, something didn't happen right with the car. 12 people have died allegedly in connection with this. This could be looking at if this does get to the point where GM has to settle, it could be a fine of much greater magnitude than what Toyota has dealt with.
Okay,
now.
Let's move on to Tesla and its fight with various states to actually sell its cars in those states and what's happening.
Well, Tesla wants to be exceptional. You know, this is Tesla's whole thing. We want to be an exceptional car company. So what Tesla wants to do is it wants to sell its cars in its own stores. It doesn't want to have to sell its cars through dealerships. All other car companies sell their cars through dealerships. So if you want to buy a new Honda, for example, you go to the Honda dealer. If you want to buy a new GM vehicle, you go to the Buick dealer or the Cadillac dealer. If you want to buy a new Ford, you go to the Ford dealer. Tesla doesn't want to do that. Tesla wants to be more like the Apple store, where you go into their store and you see the one vehicle that they're currently selling, which is the Model S sedan, starts at $70,000. They don't want to have dealers coming down and saying, hey, let's go. Let's talk about the guy. What kind of car? You want it to be blue car? Yeah, you want it to have four wheels? Ah, it's going to be fantastic.
Well, they could have a less New Jersey dealer.
That's right. Yes.
I bring up New Jersey because he's in a big fight with New Jersey, right? And, he said, oh, well, the governor promised that he could sell the cars there. I'm talking about Elon Musk. And now yes, the governor is not allowing him to do that. And he's taking on New Jersey as extremely irrational.
He says Chris Christie betrayed him.
Yeah.
Chris Christie said that we could do our kind of Tesla direct sales model here in New Jersey. And then the New Jersey legislature, obviously under significant lobbying pressure from the car dealers of New Jersey, said, and for that matter, the car dealers of the United States of America said, no way. You're not going to do it that way, Elon.
So why doesn't he just set up car dealerships then?
Well, they don't want to do that. You know, first off, because they really can't afford to do it. They don't want to follow what's called the franchise model, right? And it's a complicated arrangement that car dealers have with the manufacturers of the automobiles. So, and it entails things like the car dealers borrowing money from the car maker to finance the stock that they buy that they then later sell to customers. It's called floor plan financing. Car dealers will often be doing most of their financing through the what are called the captive lending arms, or the banks, effectively, of the car makers.
But from the perspective of the consumer, what's the better model? Because I don't think the average consumer realizes when you walk into a dealership that it's separate from the car manufacturer.
They probably don't. They do think that they're getting the car sold to them directly through some kind of vague intermediary. But in fact, they're buying the car from a separate business. Now, that business may be highly reliant on the car maker for financing, which is an important part of the car business. But obviously, Elon and Tesla want to streamline the process. What Elon wants you to do is think of it more in terms of how you would buy an iPod or a MacBook or an iPhone, something like that. He wants you to think of it as a piece of technology, as a consumer product, more than as a car. And at the same time, he wants you to think about it as a just sort of game-changing revolution in the way that we get ourselves around on four wheels.
So who's going to win?
Oh, the car dealers are going to win. They always win. So, you know, it's just
it's entrenched.
It's entrenched for good reasons, too. I mean, a lot of people have an impression of car dealers that they're out to get you. You know, they just want to gouge you. They want they want to get you in there and sell you a car no matter what. We should have a different view of car dealerships. You know, I mean, car dealerships employ about 1 million people in the U.S. And they serve a useful function. If everybody were to try to follow Tesla's model, it might actually introduce a lot of chaos into the market. And I think what Tesla's interested in doing here is just carving out an exception for itself.
Matt DeBord, freelance auto journalist, and he teaches business writing at USC. Thanks, Matt.
My pleasure.
We want to hear about your car buying experiences. Do you dread a trip to the dealership? Or maybe you are a dealer. You work at a dealership and you have a totally different perspective. Tell us your stories. We're on Facebook, KCRW's Press Play, or you can leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, what if all of a sudden you had an uncontrollable itch erupting all over your skin and then little fibers emerged from your skin? Well, thousands of people say they have this condition called Morgellons disease, but it may be just a social disease spread by the internet. That's coming up on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What if one day you woke up to the sense that your skin was teeming with some sort of bug or parasite? The itch unbearable. And after a few days, little red welts appear all over your body. And at the center of each welt, a tiny spine that catches when you run your finger over it. Ugh, my skin. I feel like I need to scratch right now. Anyway, if you have these symptoms, you might have something called Morgellons disease, or maybe not. Will Storr wrote about Morgellons. It has thousands of sufferers, and the disease may not even exist. Anyway, he wrote about this in a chapter in his new book. It's called The Unpersuadables. Will Storr, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so your story begins with this guy. His name is Paul. He's an IT specialist, and he has this exact scenario that we laid out with the red welts and the sensation of spines underneath his skin, the incredible itching. Tell us how this began for him.
Well, he was on a holiday in the States, actually, with his family. He was just watching Harry Potter in the cinema in a mall, and he just started scratching. And, you know, he thought, well, it must be sort of like bugs in the sea or something. This is weird. And then he just didn't stop scratching, and then it just got worse and worse as the holiday went on, and he went home, and he, you know, ended up in a situation where he was changing his clothes several times a day. He was constantly having hot showers. But the doctors couldn't find anything wrong with him. And, you know, he got to the stage where he was kind of getting obsessed with what these things, obviously, because he doesn't know what he's scratching at. He gets kind of obsessed, and he buys a little microscope, and he kind of sees these kind of little things sticking out of the welts. So he picks one out and brings it to the doctor. And the doctor basically says, you're crazy. This is what crazy people do. And he's diagnosed with something called delusions of parasitosis, which is what people with Morgellons tend to be told they have, i.e. they're imagining it.
They're imagining it. But Morgellons, what is that? What does that mean, first of all?
Well, that was a name that somebody gave to people suffering in this way, you know, people who have this sudden attack of itch that's come out of nowhere and who look on their skin and see little fibres and things sticking out of the cuts. It's actually like an old 18th century disease. There were some cases of children that had kind of hairs growing out of them, but it's actually unrelated. I mean, it sounded similar, so somebody just gave it the name Morgellons.
Mm. And so when did it first arise?
Well, I mean, people started noticing it and calling it Morgellons. It was kind of maybe like 10, 15 years ago. Uh-huh. That's when it started gathering a pace. And what seems to happen is that people who, you know, as we do these days, people who have these symptoms, the first thing they do is go to Google and they tap in, you know, itch, sting, scratch into Google. And what comes up, of course, is a load of websites saying, you know, Morgellons disease. So people go, oh, I've got Morgellons disease. But what they don't realize is that there's actually, according to the scientists, there's no such thing as Morgellons disease. It doesn't actually exist. And so because of the internet and because there's such a presence of these kind of people who say they've got Morgellons disease, people think they've got it, when actually, if you believe in the scientists, they've got nothing apart from maybe they're crazy.
But they have these real fibers coming out of their skin. I mean, you saw the pictures.
I know. This is a crazy thing. So, I met this guy and I met other people in the States as well who have, you know, they've got photos from microscopes. They've got, like, movie images of these things that seem to be crawling and sticking out. But what happens is that when they pick these things out and the scientists kind of test them and examine them, the scientists always come back with this idea that, it's just a carpet fiber or a piece of curtain or a piece of your jeans that's got stuck in this wound. And the reason you've got this wound is because you won't stop scratching. And you won't stop scratching because you're crazy. You know, but this sort of, you know, brings up other questions. Like the guy who I met who had it, he had these welts on parts of his back that he can't reach. So he's like, well, if I'm making these wounds, how am I doing it where I can't even reach with my fingers? So there are a lot of strange aspects to this.
So you go in search of answers and you end up at a conference of Morgellons sufferers?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I end up in a conference in the States where there are people there who, you know, they're kind of left to their own devices. They're in this void because, you know, they're told they're crazy. They're convinced they're not crazy. So what do? They start talking to each other. And I mean, really, the stories that they come up with now to explain what they might have are kind of extraordinary. Like, some people believe it's like a government secret nanotechnology project that's gone out of control. And now, you know, these crazy little tiny robots are, you know, all in the world and attacking them. Other people think it's, somebody said it was like tiny wasps. There were these tiny wasps flying around attacking us. So there were all these kind of really crazy conspiracy theories. I mean, one of the guys there was convinced it was something to do with chemtrails. And, you know, I've done a lot of writing about people who believe crazy things, and I always have this kind of rule that as soon as someone brings up chemtrails, I just think, oh, God, and I kind of shut down a bit, because that really is the litmus test of nothingness. People who believe that the vapor trails are for aeroplanes are like, you know, the government poison testing us all. So I mean, I kind of feel sorry for them in a way, because they are left in this void and their imaginations kind of go crazy because they're continually told by the powers that be that they're mistaken. They think, well, we're not mistaken, so you must be lying to us. And if you're lying to us, you've got a secret. And you can see where that ends up.
Yeah. So you leave that conference pretty sure that these people are deluded. And then you meet a guy who happens to be a doctor who says he has it.
Well, this was the crazy thing. Yeah. So, you know, not only did I leave the conference convinced they were crazy, I wrote an article for like a national newspaper saying these people are probably crazy. When this article got published, I got an email from this guy saying, I've got this thing. Exactly as you describe it, but, you know, I feel I can prove I'm not crazy. And because he lived nearby, I thought, well, okay, I'll go and see what this guy's got to say. So I turned up at his house, and it was this kind of same old story. He told me this kind of mad thing about how he was walking his dog through a graveyard of all places. Suddenly, a massive attack of itch, couldn't stop scratching. He told me this crazy thing about how he was standing in his kitchen completely naked. He had a hypodermic needle, and he was, like, picking these, like, bugs, these, like, you know, fibers out of his nipple, and the blood was all coming down. And he got some of these things, and he put them in a little baggie, and he showed it to his wife. And he says, look, I've got one. And she looked in the bag, and she was like, there's nothing there. And so I thought, you know, at this point, I'm thinking, oh, here we go again. This guy's obviously crazy. And then I said to him, so, you know, what do you do for a living? And he said, oh, I'm a physician. So I suddenly thought, well, hang on a minute. So this guy's a doctor. You know, he knows You know, he knows what he's talking about. And because he was a doctor and he was effectively diagnosing himself, he had access to, you know, experts that normal people don't have. So he sent this kind of little baggie full of what he thought were bugs to a place in London called the Natural History Museum, where all the real experts who, you know everything about bugs sort of work and hang out and identify new species. And they came back and they said, what you've got in this bag is a tropical rat mite.
Oh.
A tropical rat mite is a tiny insect that burrows under the skin and it drinks your blood. And the fibers that stick out are the bug's legs.
Oh, gosh, that is revolting.
Yeah. So that was amazing. And I mean, but the Natural History Museum were saying, well, you can't have got this because it doesn't exist in the UK. And he was like, well, you know, I have. I pulled this out of my nipple. So, I mean, my immediate response was, well, this sounds like a plausible explanation for what these people have got, right? But then when I contacted the Morgana's people, I said, look, it's really exciting. I've got this new lead. It's the tropical rat mite. They were actually furious. They were, like, really angry at me because they're so attached to this idea that it's a nanotechnology thing gone out of control or it's aliens or something.
Even your friend Paul, the guy who started your journey?
What happened, I mean, is that I think there's a bit that's not in the book where I actually hooked up Paul with the doctor and the doctor checked Paul out. And it was quite sad, actually, because the doctor said he hasn't got tropical rat mite. He's also not crazy. But this guy had been told, you know, you're delusional by his doctors formerly. He'd been through a battery of tests. They could find nothing. He was so distressed by this thing that it was causing him to be in quite a serious depression, actually. And he'd lost his job because he just couldn't, I mean, he felt itching constantly. He just couldn't concentrate as a salesman. So he lost his job. But actually, I mean, he was, when I left him, you know, extremely depressed. So, I mean, it's a terrible situation.
So what is your conclusion that maybe this doesn't exist physically, but because it is existing mentally, that it could possibly be a real disease?
Well, I mean, my conclusion is that we're making the mistake of seeing this condition as one big monolithic thing and saying, well, you know, the question we're answering, is it alien fibers or is it mad people? And actually, the answer is neither of those things. I think actually the answer is lots of people with similar symptoms who have a huge variety of root causes. I mean, one of the things that was interviewed, one of the only experts in the world on itch, on people who itch, and she said, well, you know, I've heard of Morgellons, and I think it's outrageous that these people are being told they're crazy, because you have a special nerve system in your body that's dedicated to itch, and if something goes wrong with that nerve system, there's all kinds of health conditions that you can get that can damage your itch system, and if your itch system is damaged, it sets off false alarms. So, you know, you start scratching and you start itching, and these people are just being told they're crazy. So they're not being taken seriously. So my view is that some of these people I met, they were crazy. I mean, they were kind of obsessively clean, and they were obsessed with this idea that they had aliens. I mean, I say crazy, it's not very nice to say, okay, so they were a bit delusional. But I think other people may have had tropical rat mites. Other people, no doubt, had something genuinely wrong with their itch system. But because they're just instantly dismissed as being kind of delusional, they're being left, sadly, to their own devices. I mean, to be left with a chronic itch disorder, I mean, it's an incredibly unpleasant thing.
And, I mean, you say as you were reporting this, you started getting the symptoms yourself. And it seems like a very kind of socially communicable disorder. I mean, I'm itching right now just talking about it.
I know, it's awful, isn't it? Sorry, no, it was completely. And I actually got quite worried at one stage because, not that I had Morgellons, but because I just thought maybe I was going mad myself, because it got to the stage where I started doing what Paul was doing. I started having like 3 showers a day. It was just for a period of a couple of days. And I started thinking, if I don't stop doing this, I might end up like him. But luckily, it kind of, when I filed the story and started working on something else, it kind of went away. But there is something really interesting about that idea of communicable itch. It seems to be that, I mean, I'm actually scratching my neck as I'm talking. As soon as you start talking about it, your itch system goes crazy and starts kind of flashing and malfunctioning and causing us to scratch when there's nothing really to scratch at.
Wow, so fascinating, because it really is revealing about the mind-body connection and how much we don't know about that.
Absolutely.
Will Storr is a journalist. He's based in the UK. His new book is called The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science. And the story on the mystery itching disease is a chapter from the book. You can read it in Matter magazine. Will, thank you so much.
No, thanks for talking to me.
Well, if you have the itch to watch the Dodgers play and you live in L.A. and you want to watch them play on TV and you don't have Time Warner, you're really out of luck. A new deal with the Dodgers is shutting out a lot of fans. Why that, though, might be a good thing eventually for all TV watchers. That story coming up on Press Play. First, a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. The Dodgers open their season this weekend against the Arizona Diamondbacks in Australia. But here at home, there's only one way you can watch the Dodgers on TV. A $7 billion deal between the Dodgers and Time Warner Cable has created a channel called Sportsnet LA. And that channel has exclusive rights to all Dodger TV broadcasts. So if you have any other provider except for Time Warner, like Dish, UVerse, DirecTV, you're just out of luck. John Nathanson is sports and tech columnist for Slate and has been looking into this new Dodgers TV channel. And he says the business model could change the way cable TV operates. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into that, can you first run down the details of this Dodger Time Warner cable deal?
Sure. So I think it all starts off with ESPN. It's by far one of the most profitable cable stations in the world. And so in recent years, you've had players like Fox Sports, which for the last 10 years or so, almost 20 years, has owned the local broadcast rights to the Dodgers. As of 2 years ago, those rights lapsed. And what happened is the Dodgers themselves decided, in partnership with Time Warner, to create their own owned and operated cable channel. And that is the genesis of Sportsnet LA.
And aren't there other teams that do that? I think the Knicks did that, right?
A lot of local sports teams are getting in on this business now. And the reason being that it's such a moneymaker. Sports is the one must-see event in television. It's the one thing that keeps people glued to their television sets at a specific day, date, and time in a way that no other television programming can do.
But then the Dodgers are shutting out a big swath of their fan base because a lot of people don't have Time Warner.
They are, and everyone in L.A. is upset about it. And, you know, it's been all over the L.A. Times. I haven't heard the end of it from my friends. I'm certainly annoyed living out of state and not being able to see them. Essentially, what happens is the Dodgers, having struck this $7 billion deal with Time Warner, have then gone out with Time Warner and attempted to sell this to Dish, to Cox, to the other providers. So far, none of those other players have bit, and so accordingly, right now, if you're not a Time Warner subscriber, you're not going to be able to see the Dodgers.
And those other providers didn't bite because it would be too expensive for them?
It'd be very expensive. And there's rumors that they're going to eventually strike a deal probably in the next couple weeks. Now, what will happen if that's the case is you will, if you are a Dish subscriber, if you are a Cox subscriber, you'll get your Dodgers coverage midway into the season, which is certainly what no one wants.
Oh, okay. So basically, I guess the bad guys in this, from the fans' perspective, are the Dodgers and Time Warner.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting because in theory, they should be. Now, what happens is the fans don't necessarily know who to blame. All they know is that they see that their local provider isn't carrying the Dodgers. So they get mad at their local provider. And so that's exactly what Time Warner and the Dodgers are figuring. That's what they're calculating will happen. So if I am not a Time Warner subscriber and I call up and you know, yell at my local cable provider, I will threaten to go to Time Warner, as is currently happening now. And that's the entire sort of that's the bargaining chip. It's pay our licensing fee or you're going to lose subscribers to us.
So How will this change the way cable TV works?
So what's happening is this is now a thing. This is a fad. Every sports team is now getting into this sort of business. Now, as I mentioned earlier, originally, these regional sports networks, as they're called, these sort of regional networks that carry local teams, were owned by national companies like Fox Sports. Increasingly, there's this trend toward individual teams wanting that action for themselves, commanding very large fees. You know, this $7 billion fee is nothing out of the ordinary. We've seen $8 billion here, $6 billion there for various sports teams. So what'll happen is, in local markets, the tail will wag the dog. You'll have the Dodgers and other teams like them commanding billions of dollars, and that cost is then carried through to the entire cable package. So if you're not a sports fan, if you're not a Dodgers fan, but you happen to live in LA, you will be paying for the Dodgers.
Okay, so what about unbundling? This brings up the whole issue that we've talked about, you know, for a long time and hasn't happened yet, the desire for TV cable subscribers to have unbundled programming.
And what I think will happen is I believe this issue will finally start to drive a wedge between sports fans and non-sports fans. So as it stands right now, the average cable bill in the next 5 years or so is projected to reach $200 a month. That's average. So, and that's largely driven by sports. And so when prices get that high, we're finally going to start to see a lot of consumer pressure. Consumers will say, especially non-sports fans, which is roughly call that 40% of the country, will start to say enough is enough. And so what will probably happen is market forces, probably a runner-up cable network in a certain market, maybe the number two or three player in a market will decide, I'm going to offer a non-sports package. And not only that, but by offering a non-sports package, I can slash a lot of those costs out of the deal and offer essentially a very bargain, you know, bargain-priced cable network to non-sports fans. I believe that it, more than any other possibility, could start to affect unbundling. And even that is not necessarily a given.
So there could be a happy ending to this for people who have wanted to have their cable bills unbundled.
There could be, and I think that it'll either happen through something like that or, you know, through an unnamed party right now. There's talk that it's a rumor, and I can't substantiate it too much, but there's a rumor that Google is talking to some sports networks and might even be sort of entering the cable business in and of its own right. It's building a lot of infrastructure called Fiber, which is a big fiber optic network. It's rolling out in certain cities. And so what might happen is if the cable business itself can't unbundle, then other people will.
Wow. Interesting. In the meantime, how do we watch Dodger games in real time if we don't have Time Warner?
You've got to go out to a bar or find a very generous friend.
Or listen on the radio, I guess.
Exactly.
John Nathanson on sports, and he's also a tech columnist for Slate, and he's been looking into the new Dodgers TV channel for us. Thank you, John.
Madeline, thank you for having me.
In other LA TV news, the CEO of LA's public TV station, KCET, is stepping down after 18 years. Al Jarreau presided over the station during a tumultuous time for public TV stations everywhere, but especially right here. A few years ago, he decided to break with PBS just before that network's huge hit, Downton Abbey, debuted. In terms of audience and fundraising, it's been downhill for KCET ever since. Judy Muller joins us now to talk about whether KCET can rise from the ashes. She's a longtime TV journalist who worked at KCET for years. Full disclosure, I worked there as well. And now she teaches journalism at USC Annenberg. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, take us back to 2010 and the decision Al Jarreau made to divorce KCET from PBS. Why did he do that?
Well, this was a fight over subscription costs. In order to be part of PBS and get their programming, you have to pay fees. And Al Jarreau and his board felt those fees were exorbitant, and they had a face-off with PBS. And, they decided to go their own way as an independent station and break off with PBS. The timing couldn't have been worse. This was right before Downton Abbey premiered. So all of that audience, I would say 90% of KCET's audience, fled to KOCE, which was the Orange County station that then picked up the PBS programming, which was a windfall for them. And by doing nothing, they picked up this enormous audience.
Right.
And I understand that there were even people who had been, you know, donors to KCET who were calling the offices there and asking for their money back, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
So it was an immediately destructive, in terms of financial issues, a very bad decision from the point of view of people who are thinking, wow, what was that all about? I think he felt, Al Jarreau, that in a city like Los Angeles, which is, you know, centered in the entertainment capital of the world and film, that an independent station could do well, you know, by getting regular original programming. And the problem was that wasn't in place. So there was nothing to fill the gap. And meanwhile, they lost all this audience and all this money in underwriting.
And so that was kind of a snowball effect. So you have the audience leaving and then the funders saying, well, we're not going to fund you because you don't have an audience. So it just became...
Yes. And we had a show called SoCal Connected at that time, which had grown out of something else, which was an earlier show, California Connected.
This is a new show that I worked on as well.
Yes, you worked on it. I worked on it for many years. It was a show that really, a news broadcast that really filled a hole, a vacuum in Los Angeles news, I believe, which doesn't do very much investigative original reporting here in L.A. The regular commercial stations don't. And this show, on a fairly shoestring budget, it had a good budget, but it wasn't exorbitant by any means, using network experienced correspondents, producers, editors, cameramen, women, went out and did some amazing investigative pieces, won many national awards, a Peabody for our marijuana exposés, which nobody else was covering. And that got laws changed. Columbia DuPont for a number of issues dealing with public affairs in L.A.
And this is the top of the Broadcast Journalism Awards. This isn't just...
Yes, yeah. The top... And many Emmys and Golden Mikes. Many, many awards. The audience, though, was never huge. It had an impact, this journalism, in terms of getting laws changed. Certainly people in city council paid attention. But I think it never got that huge audience that it could have deserved. Huell Hauser was the big draw to KCET at the time. Of course, he died last year. Now they're doing reruns of Huell Hauser. That is not what you call, you know, forward-looking, energetic programming.
Right.
And then, of course, KCET canceled SoCal Connected, and all of us found that we no longer had a show to report for. And I think that was a huge loss for the city of Los Angeles because there's nothing that really takes its place.
It costs a lot of money, which was the reason why it was
well,
not...
good journalism does cost money. You can go to the web, and they've done a good job, I think, of going multi-platform with Juan Devis. He's in charge of their multi-media programming, and he's done a good job with their website. But if you're going to be an independent public television station, you've got to do television.
Mm-hmm.
And they never really filled that vacuum.
Well, in fact, that's how they're spinning it now in their press release. They're saying that we look forward to an exciting digital future, I guess an online future. And so, I mean, what is the future for KCET? It needs to raise a lot of money. Apparently, the recent audit said there's substantial doubt that it can stay in business in the long term, and it lost millions of dollars in the last fiscal year. What needs to happen for it to bounce back?
Well, they've got to get money. And the Amundsen Foundation gave them some money. I think it was $1 million for SoCal Connected in some very, very stripped-down form to go on, but not the way it was before, not with the network producer-level people coming in and doing all these great programming, all these great stories. So I think that audit was really the shot across the bow. I mean, I think that's probably why you're seeing Al Jarreau retiring today. Because when you lose millions and millions of dollars 2 years in a row with nothing else coming in to counteract it, I think the handwriting's on the wall. I've used so many cliches in that sentence, I don't even know where to begin.
But, and you, teaching TV and radio journalism.
Tell, right.
Only time will tell.
Yeah.
A great way to sign off. All right, Judy Muller.
Okay.
That's a perfect ender. Judy Muller, who teaches journalism at USC Annenberg, thank you.
You bet.
Time will tell what's on at 1 p.m. in 15 minutes.
Time indeed will. I just have to say that all of us who ever worked at KCET
you
are
did as well.
Sorry
That's
to
right.
see what
We're
is
all
taking
alumni.
Place over there. We're going to see a very interesting, or here rather, to the point, a very interesting sort of tamping down of alarm about what's going on between Ukraine and Crimea and Russia from a veteran diplomat, veteran guy at the CIA. Also a man who advises clients who are investors as to what the chances are of this escalating much beyond what it already is. That's very interesting.
Okay, we'll look forward to that in 15 minutes to the point. And Warren Olney, thank you.
Okay.
And coming up before that here on this program, how the Oscar Pistorius murder trial has really taken over South Africa. It's become that country's OJ trial. And aside from the salacious details, the trial has really given rise to serious debate over women's rights, racism, violence, freedom of speech in that fairly new democracy. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's week three of the Oscar Pistorius murder trial in South Africa. The trial has made headlines around the world because it involves a star athlete, his model girlfriend, and a Valentine's Day murder. Pistorius competed in the London Olympics 2 years ago. He's known as the Blade Runner because he's a double amputee who runs on two carbon fiber blades. And last year, on Valentine's Day, he shot and killed his girlfriend. He says he mistook her for an intruder. Prosecutors say he killed her during an argument. The trial has transfixed South Africa. It's basically that country's OJ trial. And here to talk about how the country has been taken over by this trial is Anton Harbour. He's professor of journalism at Wits University in Johannesburg. He's also a veteran South African journalist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, tell us, how huge is this trial in South Africa? Is everybody watching it online, on TV, and talking about it?
It's just absolutely huge. It's taken over our lives. It's superseded our upcoming elections as the biggest story in all our media. We have two pop-up TV channels, which have sprung up on satellite TV specially for this, and a pop-up radio station. So there's just saturation coverage. And a good deal of the country is just watching with extraordinary interest and debating. And it's brought a rich and interesting debate about gender and race and femicide and our gun culture and our fear of intruders and all sorts of parts of the underbelly of this country.
Fascinating. And also because it involves one of the country's heroes, Oscar Pistorius.
Well, it's an extraordinary soap opera story. An absolute hero, a man who overcome extraordinary disability and challenges to become a global icon, and his beautiful and much-loved model girlfriend, and he kills her on Valentine's Day. If you wrote it as a soap opera, I think it would get rejected as not believable.
Hmm. Well, talk about some of the issues that you mentioned in the beginning of this interview and how they're resonating and being debated in South Africa. And let's talk about this. I mean, this is let's remind our listeners, a very young democracy, 20 years old only.
Certainly. Well, our courts, in line with our constitution and its commitment to transparency and openness, our courts have been moving to greater and greater access for the media. But this is the first full criminal trial in which most of it is to be shown on live television. I guess that's a similarity with the O.J. Simpson trial in that it's got everyone watching and debating and discussing every legal nicety of the trial. But what's also made it remarkable is that it's the first social media trial where the first and leading reporting and conversation and discussion of all the issues is on social media, so we're all learning a new set of rules, a new set of behavior. And the court, as it goes along, is trying to deal with the impact of this new media and this kind of openness for a trial of this magnitude.
And what is it revealing in terms of how South Africa is and has been divided along racial lines?
You know, it's a very, should I say, white trial. The victim and the accused are both white. The lawyers are mostly white. In the court, the only prominent black person is, in fact, the judge. We don't have a jury system here, so it's a judge and two assessors. The judge is a black woman. But lurking in the story is what I would call the intruder. Pistorius is saying that he thought there was an intruder, and that's why he fired shots through the closed and locked bathroom door that killed his girlfriend. And really what you see there is that fear of an intruder whose race isn't mentioned, but clearly in everyone's minds here is a black intruder. And so what it really, the underlying story here is one of race and femicide and a gun culture that has emerged. Oscar Pistorius was just a gun fanatic in a way that I suppose a certain class and type of South African is associated with.
You've used the word femicide, and is there a big problem with that in South Africa, with women being killed in domestic violence? Yeah.
Domestic violence, femicide, domestic femicide, is a huge problem in this country. We have very high figures for domestic violence and intimate femicide, I suppose it's often called, people killing their partners. So really this has highlighted a number of deep problems in the underbelly of our new and young and developing democracy. But, you know, another major factor here is that Pistorius is a wealthy man and a very well-known man, and he clearly can afford the best defense, I suppose not unlike O.J. Simpson. And so what we're seeing on our television is not the experience of the justice system that most South Africans have. I think, to put it crudely, you're seeing rich person's justice, the best of South African justice, the best that money can buy, being played out in our courts. But I think there's an awareness that what goes on in our courts most of the time is often a very different experience.
And how are the different groups in South Africa viewing this trial, the different races?
It's very difficult to break down. And there's clearly much more interest among white South Africans than black South Africans. What you could broadly call the black media is not giving it as much attention as the white media. But I think there is a sense that it speaks to a lot of issues in this country, and therefore there is interest. And in fact, for a lot of people, judging by the conversations one hears and picks up in the media, for a lot of people, they've never seen a criminal trial in such detail. And so there's a huge process going on of people coming to understand the complicated nature of these processes. I think there's an enormous political significance weighing on whether there is justice in the end and what the outcome is, and whether his very expensive, very good, very smart lawyers can get him off.
So what do you think will happen if he's found not guilty?
I think there will be a very strong reaction to a feeling that this is rich man's justice.
Anton Harbor, professor of journalism at Wits University and longtime veteran journalist in South Africa. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us now, as always, Jolie Myers.
Hi, Madeline.
Mail. Hi.
I've got the mail. We talked about cars up top.
We
wanted to know about your car buying stories, your experiences. I asked on Facebook as well, and I baited you all by posting a beautiful picture of my new car. Her name is Sailor Betty. She's gorgeous. Chevy Cruze. When I was test driving, though, the salesman was impressed by my ability to navigate the test drive. And he was like, wow, women never have a good sense of direction.
Are you
I'm
kidding?
Like, do you even want me to buy a car from you? Like, what? No, I will go elsewhere. Like, word to the wise, try not saying that next time. I bought it anyway, so apparently he wins. But, well, Ricardo called in, and he said he is so over the dealership system.
Frankly, I see no point in having these guys sell us cars. It should be like buying bread. That makes no sense. Other than to add a markup, what would be the worst that would happen? That you buy a car that you don't want? This doesn't make any sense.
I like the idea of going to a dealership to buy bread, like the markup on a baguette. But he goes on to say that the dealership model is on the way out, like a lot of different kinds of industries. Tech is going to find a better solution. Guy called in too. He has bought his cars from the same dealership since 1986. He says he's not planning on stopping anytime soon. He loves his dealership.
Having said that, I love the whole concept of Tesla and wish I could afford one. I love how they're sticking it to the dealer network and saying, we're not going to do that. We want to sell on our own. I totally want them to succeed with that.
I'm sure Tesla will be glad to hear that, but Guy's dealership, maybe not so much. Charles Walker left a comment on our Facebook page, Beyond the Car Buying Experience, and he points out that we talked about the GM recall, that when GM went through bankruptcy, they shed a lot of the liability issues from cars that they made pre-bankruptcy. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, thanks, Charles.
Thank you for that, and thank you to... you, Julie Myers.
Oh, you're so welcome, Madeline.
Right now.
You are so welcome.
And good luck with your car. Congratulations on Sailor Betty. I'm sure you'll have a long, prosperous union. And if you'd like to contact us, you are invited to. Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Leave a voicemail. We're on Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. That's it for me, Warren Olney. And To The Point, up next, I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.